Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. A recent nuclear deal with Iran has brought the topic of nuclear weapons to the forefront of national attention. Today's guest is Joel Rubin, Director of Policy and Government Affairs at Plowshares Fund, a foundation dedicated to ridding the world of nuclear weapons. Rubin visited Penn State last week to speak at the School of International Affairs. WPSU's Kate Lau Schaffner sat down with him to talk about why Americans should be worried about the state of nuclear weapons today and about why the Iran nuclear weapons deal is so important.
Joel Rubin, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be with you.
So tell me about the Plowshares Fund.
We are a foundation dedicated to preventing the spread of nuclear weapons. We're 30-plus years old, and our mission is to seek a more peaceful world that is more secure, and our work is in Washington as well as across the country, where we support a variety of experts and advocates and people who seek the same objective.
The name Plowshares, I believe it's from Scripture.
It is. It certainly is. And beating swords into plowshares is certainly the vision for the organization. It really grew up during the early 80s and the nuclear freeze movement and the whole vision of avoiding nuclear war between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. And since that time, it's evolved. And one of the things that is so important for Americans to understand is that we and Russia together have 95% of the world's nuclear weapons. These are weapons that are probably not ever going to be used. Certainly, we hope not. And it's expensive. And in these times, it's a hard program to maintain fiscally. And it certainly makes it harder on our defense budget. And we're trying to explain to Americans why we need to think twice about the kind of arsenal we currently have and what we need it for.
When I was preparing for this interview, I asked around. I asked people, what do you think of nuclear weapons, or do you even think about nuclear weapons at all? And some admitted they don't really, doesn't really cross their mind. They say there are more pressing topics like poverty or ongoing active conflicts, disease. And yet, you know, Plowshares Fund, the entire mission is to bring nuclear weapons to people's attention. Why do you think people should be thinking about it?
Well, I grew up in the 70s in Pittsburgh, and I remember in middle school seeing The Day After, and that stuck with me. We're lucky right now. There's no Soviet Union pointing nuclear weapons at us in a threatening manner, but still Russia does point nuclear weapons at us. We need to remain vigilant. Any mistake, perhaps by the U.S. Or Russia, could be cataclysmic. There are countries right now who also have nuclear weapons, like Pakistan, for instance, that are in a very unstable part of the world, and they themselves are unstable. Terrorist organizations are roaming that country. We have the potential for nuclear proliferation, meaning the spreading of nuclear weapon states in the Middle East with Iran and a diplomatic program underway to prevent them from getting a bomb. These things are costly. They're the most deadly weapons on the planet, and we're safer without them than we are with them. And that's really the goal. Nuclear weapons certainly don't jump to the fore of what people think about in the immediate term, but it's a legacy issue from the Cold War that we need to deal with, and we need to make sure that we're doing it in a smart way.
The United States not only developed nuclear weapons, but it's the only country to have used them during wartime. Of course, Hiroshima and Nagasaki in World War II. What do you think is the United States' role in limiting the development or use of nuclear weapons?
The American role is twofold. First is to provide leadership on a global level to ensure that we are supporting the kinds of international agreements that bind countries into verifiably ensuring that they're either not getting nuclear weapons or maintaining clear control over their arsenals. And the second is to lead by example and to demonstrate that we can reduce our arsenal in concert with our security, as well as maintain the kind of arsenal that we need that's the most practical and realistic, and do so in a manner that can encourage other countries to reduce their number of nuclear weapons. You know, there are roughly 22,000 nuclear weapons in the world. I mentioned that 95% are between the U.S. and Russia. We just negotiated, the U.S. and Russia did a couple of years ago, a treaty known as New START to reduce the levels that both countries have. The current level that we are allowed under this treaty is 1,550 deployed nuclear warheads. Now, many experts say that if 1 to 200 nuclear weapons were unleashed, we would have a nuclear winter, which could cost the lives of hundreds of millions of people. It's hard to imagine why we need 1,500, let alone 5,000 in storage. And so these are the kinds of issues that we as Americans need to be aware of. It costs a lot, and it increases the risk of one of these going off. And frankly, it's a bloated complex that doesn't fit the security challenges like terrorism and cybersecurity issues that we're most worried about right now. The U.S. needs to lead by example, needs to lead the global community, and needs to do so in a way that really supports our security, both physical and financial.
Some might say it's unfair for nations who have developed nuclear weapons, such as the United States, to forbid others from developing them as well, because it's not like the U.S. is going to get rid of all of theirs all at once and while they're telling other people not to develop them.
It's a really important point to bring out, and there's a simple response, which is that we have an international structure through the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty that clarifies the rules of the road. And it's in nobody's interest to have more nuclear weapon states. And because the U.S. has them, does not provide a justification for a country that does not to go and get them. From where I sit, it's better to roll back all programs. So we need to make sure that what we have is under control, that it is safe and secure and reliable, and that we're not seeing more states get them. You know, when you look at India and Pakistan as an example, you're looking at a situation where they had illicit nuclear programs, weapons programs developed over years, and then they tested in the late 90s in a manner that essentially cut them off from the U.S. and other countries. There was a global condemnation of that. Why? Because it introduces a level of fear and a danger that is unnecessary in the current in the current environment. And we're looking at that question about Iran. Right now, Iran does not have a nuclear weapon. We want to make sure it never does. At the same time, though, as you point out, if we're not leading, and if we're not showing that we, too, take this seriously and that we're rolling back our program in a secure and verifiable manner, we undercut our moral authority as well as our practical authority on this issue. So all of these issues go hand in glove, and they do matter. But certainly to see more countries getting the bomb won't make us more secure.
You mentioned the New START in 2010. START 1, of course, was 1991.
Yes.
Have these treaties worked? Is this the way to go?
The good news story is that we're at historically low levels of nuclear arsenals between the U.S. and Russia compared to the peak in the 50s and the 60s, and we're in the 30s of thousands of nuclear warheads. And treaties, by their nature, are legally binding documents that increase transparency over what each side has and also lock them in to a program of reducing their arsenal that builds confidence between the sides. When the Soviet Union fell in 91, 92, in that period, there was a big question hovering over Washington about what to do with that nuclear arsenal that was sitting not just in Russia, but in all of the satellite republics, the 14 or 15 new countries in that region, and deep fear that they would disappear, that they would create new nuclear weapon states. Well, there was a concerted program, a bipartisan-led program by Senators Lugar and Nunn to capture those nuclear weapons, and it was done in concert with Russia and those countries. And the START Treaty, separately, but also a strategic arms reduction treaty, was also done with that same mindset of let's build confidence between these different countries, these new countries, and let's take weapons off the table. And what was passed in 2010 by the Senate, ratified by the Senate and signed into law by the president, was another layer of confidence building over this arsenal. It's such a sensitive arsenal, any mistake could be cataclysmic, and it's in all of our interest to see the numbers reduced while maintaining security. And how do you have security? When you know that the other side is also reducing its numbers, and that builds confidence, and that's certainly what that treaty in 2010 provided.
When I was canvassing my friends and acquaintances for thoughts on nuclear weapons, there's this idea that, you know, it's Pandora's box. Mm-hmm. The cat's out of the bag. You can't put it back in. Plowshares, yeah. The goal is to eradicate nuclear weapons, is it not? Do you think it's possible?
Well, the goal is to ultimately never have them used again.
Never have them used.
Never have them used again. And the best way to do that is to not have them. Short of that, what can be done? What can be done is reducing the numbers to a level where the controls are very sufficient and strong, having governments be transparent about what they have, ensuring that publics are engaged and weighing in on this question. You know, it goes to the premise of the question and also the interesting description you have of canvassing your friends, which is, our publics are not fully engaged in this question. Right now we're seeing a lot of reporting coming out about our intercontinental ballistic missile staff, the missileers, they call them, where there are new scandals popping up, it seems like every day, of drug use.
What does it look like right now? We talk about nuclear weapons. Is it just there's this big bunker with weapons and it's not engaged, it's just in storage? That's not the case.
No, it's not. It's deployed. And part of the treaty with Russia being deployed means it's ready to go. It's ready to be fired. We have what is known as a triad of delivery systems of these weapons. They are delivered by planes, bombers, by missiles, and by sea through subs. And the latest news that we're hearing about the missileers, the land-based missiles, known as the ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, is that the missileers, meaning the people who are actually responsible for shooting those missiles and are sitting in the bunker underground waiting for the call, that their core is in disarray, that there's cheating on testing of their capacity, that there's drug use, that one of the leaders was fired for or engaging with prostitutes in Russia. I mean, there's a lot going on there, and this is very sensitive stuff. If there's a mistake in this nuclear arsenal, you can't get it back. You can't get back the thousands, hundreds of thousands of lives potentially. So we need to be very vigilant. And the American public has largely been out of this discussion for a number of years. In addition to that, the costs of maintaining the arsenal, again, $500 to $600 billion, the Congressional Budget Office just estimated that it'll be a $570 billion price tag over the next decade. We're talking about huge sums of money that could be going to other defense expenditures that are instead going to this arsenal. So I think that the question of not ever having nuclear weapons used again is integrated with this question about the size of your arsenal, the management of it, the transparency of it, and seeing its ultimate elimination over time in concert with your security. All of that comes together. But ultimately, we want to make sure there's never another nuclear war.
It's interesting to hear, there are personnel who are poised to use these weapons, mm-hmm. even though there's hopefully no use for them, or there's no plan to use them. But that's still going on.
They're on hair trigger alert, prompt launch, as they call it, and they're there and ready. And that's actually one of the longstanding requests from the arms control community, which is to get off of that posture, that we're not in that anymore. We're not staring down the Soviet Union, and we need to reduce the potential risk of a mistaken launch that is currently possible with our prompt launch posture. And here's part of the trick, is it's not just politics, it's not just public debate. It's also bureaucracy, and the nuclear infrastructure in this country is bureaucratically entrenched and has been around for 60 plus years.
When we have discussions about nuclear weapons, it's largely in terms of political nation states or countries. And yet in many of the conflicts today, the players aren't countries. It's terrorist groups, extremist groups, or even wars between ethnic groups. Do you think there's reason to fear that these weapons can be used by these groups that aren't controllable? They're not signing any treaties.
There's certainly always a concern about that. Al-Qaeda, for instance, it was understood that they were attempting to seize materials, potentially for a dirty bomb, which is not the same as a nuclear weapon being discharged and with the explosive material. There is always a concern about that. There's a bigger concern about rogue regimes. Certainly North Korea comes to mind as far as a country that has the physical infrastructure to deploy a nuclear-tipped missile. But when you're talking about terrorist activity and you think about Pakistan in particular, it's as much about the capacity of the state itself to manage and maintain that arsenal as anything else. And when there's a country like Pakistan that has instability, it's not falling apart, it's not melting down, but there's instability. It creates pressures on the security establishment. And one has to always make sure that they have full control of their arsenal and that it is not potentially being exposed to unnecessary risk. And that's the issue here, which is the more weapons that you have, the greater the potential risk that it could fall into the wrong hands.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Our guest is Joel Rubin, the Director of Policy and Government Affairs at Plowshares Fund. He's talking with Kate Lau Schaffner about the recent nuclear weapons agreement with Iran.
Let's go back a little bit and talk more about Iran. So the five permanent
the flavor
members,
of the moment.
Well, I mean, it's
not
interesting.
Not just the moment. It's a great issue.
It's interesting, too, because it brings the talk about nuclear weapons on the table, even if, you're saying we need to think about this beyond just Iran. But at least now we're talking about it.
Exactly.
So the five permanent members of the Security Council plus Germany reached an agreement with Iran last November the 24th, I believe.
Yes.
And that began being implemented January 20th, so very recently. What are the details of this agreement?
This agreement, for the first time in a decade, begins to roll back the Iranian nuclear program and does so in a verifiable manner. It is technically going to have Iran eliminate the most dangerous materials in its program. Those would be the 20% enriched uranium, of which they have less than one bomb's worth, but nonetheless they have it. And they are no longer going to enrich to that level, and they're going to eliminate what they have, and that will be verified by the International Atomic Energy Agency. It's going to stop construction at a plutonium production facility, which is another pathway to a bomb. It's also going to provide daily inspections into Iran, into their sensitive nuclear facilities, into certain uranium mines and other areas where there have been many legitimate questions about what Iran is up to. But in addition to that, it's going to open the door to a fuller comprehensive negotiation between the Western powers and Iran over the full dimensions of the kind of nuclear program it will have going forward. The goal here is about ensuring that Iran never gets the bomb.
So it's stopping progress towards a nuclear weapon, but it's not removing any capacity to build one.
This is where the political debate enters, and it's an important political debate. The goal here is to get control of Iran's nuclear program. We want control over that. We want to make sure that they don't go where we don't want them to go. And ideally, all of their nuclear infrastructure would be dismantled. Ideally, they would have no nuclear sites, even though they currently have a dozen. Ideally, they would have no enrichment and no centrifuges spinning, even though they have 19,000. Ideally, they would renounce their interest in nuclear technology, even though across the political spectrum in Iran, they all support a nuclear program. We're not going to get the ideal, but what we can do is get the good. And we can get the good in a way that extends the ability of Iran to have a nuclear weapon, that ensures that we would catch them, that takes off the table the kinds of equipment that they need to get there, and that we are verifying this on a continual basis. This is the kind of, let's call it, stressful state that we'll be in. But I think that that's the kind of stressful state that if Iran buys into it, then you have confidence. With Korea in the 90s, we built a program where they essentially said they'll dismantle it all. And we loved it. And then they cheated. We don't want them to cheat. We don't want them to say, yes, we'll dismantle everything and then go behind our back and cheat. We want Iran to say, we're going to keep something, and we want to say you can have something so that everything can be transparent and that there will not be any cheating. That's the goal here, and I think it is something that is actually possible.
The current agreement includes inspections and transparency.
Well, the current agreement does, and this they call it the first step agreement, is constructed in a way to not allow Iran to advance its nuclear program during the negotiations over the next 6 months, are known as the comprehensive negotiations. And that's been a key ask of folks who are worried about Iran's nuclear program. They would argue, how can one negotiate with Iran over its nuclear program while they continue to spin centrifuges and amass uranium, enriched uranium, and advance? Well, this first step agreement that has just been implemented stops that. It doesn't allow Iran to continue to advance its program. It freezes it in place and rolls back some key parts and allows negotiations to go forward over the comprehensive deal without that threat hovering over the negotiations.
And in return, sanctions are lifted against Iran.
No.
Okay.
No. This is a really important point. Opponents of diplomacy who are arguing against the current agreement with Iran are saying that sanctions are over. That's not accurate.
Well, is it accurate to say some sanctions are over? I know Iran is starting to court these multinational corporations to come back, and some of their assets that have been frozen up are now being released.
It's accurate to say that some economic relief is being provided, but no executive orders have been issued renouncing sanctions. No legislation has passed renouncing sanctions. And the Treasury Department has not stopped enforcing sanctions. So, no, they have not. Stop sanctions. Yes, they have used some of what they've captured as part of an economic relief package to provide incentives. You know, this is a negotiation, carrots and sticks. If it's all stick, we're never going to get anywhere.
So let me re-ask that. What does Iran get in return?
What they get is they get modest economic relief. They'll get $4.2 billion in cash payments over the next 6 months, and then several billion more. It'll be totaling roughly $7 billion in the ability at least to sell gold, petrochemicals, and get other types of smaller transactions going. And so it's about a $7 billion package. Now, it's important to point out that the $4.2 billion in cash payment is Iranian money that is currently being sequestered or held in foreign banks due to our punishing sanctions. So we will be releasing to them their money, but we'll be holding on to $96 billion more that's sitting in the banks. And every month over the next 6 months, they'll still be losing roughly $8 billion a month in potential revenue because of our current sanctions, which are still in place. And that's a key thing to understand. We have something the Iranians want at the table. And this is a good leverage point. We have very tough oil and banking sanctions on them that are supported by the international community and that are causing real pain in Iran. And that is what has brought Iran to the table, the prospect of getting rid of those sanctions. So now is the moment to use that leverage and to get out of them a secure, verifiable agreement to stop that nuclear program and to roll it back where we can have confidence that they will never get the bomb. That is what we're looking at right now. But in this interim period, those sanctions that are in place will stay in place.
You mentioned multiple times it's interim. It's 6 months. It seems like a lot could happen in 6 months.
Yeah, 6 months ago, we didn't have the current president of Iran as even nobody predicted he would even come close to winning that election that he did in June.
And you've said that the Iranian people deserve credit for choosing him as president.
Yes.
President Rouhani is quite a contrast to the former president, Ahmadinejad, who is extremely hostile to the West.
Very hostile to Israel, very hostile to the U.S.
And Rouhani actually campaigned for greater moderation and to extremism, and actually brought to the table a discussion about the nuclear program. So should, I don't know, what do you think about this change of leadership?
For us and for our country's security, we have to be very clear-eyed about who we're dealing with here. We're dealing with the Iranian regime, which is a theocratic regime, which has oppressed its people for decades, which has engaged in supporting international terrorism, which has developed an illicit nuclear program. The president of Iran, Rouhani, is part of that establishment. That's a baseline. We also have to understand that that is who we have in front of us, and we can deal with him and deal with his country in a way that advances our interests and does so in a manner that doesn't get Americans killed. You know, we just spent the past decade engaged in wars in the Middle East, including a major war of choice in Iraq, to push our policy. It backfired. Not only did it kill thousands of people, many of whom served honorably, all who served honorably, frankly, and I was a career officer at the State Department during the time, and it was a really challenging period. But we went to war in the belief that A, we would prevent Saddam Hussein from getting a nuclear weapon, and B, strike a blow against terrorism. And today we're watching the country of Iraq still in chaos, and frankly, there were no weapons of mass destruction. And so we don't need to make that mistake again. What we need to do is to use war as a last resort. And we don't have that. We're not at that point right now. So with Rouhani, his coming in, and he won an election landslide in June, it was based upon the argument that he could repair Iran's relations with the West, and the Iranian people supported it. Now, I don't know why he won. I would guess that that had something to do with it. Also, frankly, Iran is hurting economically. But whatever the reason, Rouhani has chosen to reach out and has chosen to argue inside Tehran, the capital, as well as internationally, about how Iran wants to make a deal and wants to get out from under the sanctions and does not have an interest in a nuclear bomb. So now we test, and we have clear ways to measure, but now we test. We don't turn our back on this opportunity because we don't want to be in a situation where several years from now, because we didn't test it, we're really left with that last resort choice of military action.
Right. And you've even said this deal is actually a huge win for the administration and for Congress.
It is. It is. Both. It's a bipartisan victory. This is years in the making. This is what those of us who worked on sanctions, and I did when I was in Congress as a staffer, this is what we were waiting for. This was the moment to see if Iran would come and say, get us out from under these. What do you need? Right now, that's what the discussion is about.
Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was WPSU's Kate Lau Schaffner talking with Joel Rubin during his visit last week to Penn State. Rubin is Director of Policy and Government Affairs at Plowshares Fund. Plowshares Fund is an underwriter of NPR. Rubin is also a frequent commentator on national security issues for CBS, MSNBC, Al Jazeera, and the BBC, among many others. To read more about his views on this issue, check the links on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.